get it.
All right. Denise, you ready to go?
Yeah.
It's early in the morning. It's almost 7:04.
Well, yeah.
July the 19th. Well. And Denise, the hits keep coming.
Why is it that whenever you say that, I know that you're about to tell me something about the President of the United States, I really am going to wish I didn't know.
Well, you already know this already, I'm sure, that we have a new definition for the word no. You know.
It's no longer just no. You know, no. I thought that we had pretty much established what no meant.
No, we haven't. My man is just, oh, wow. It's incredible. It's incredible. We'll get to that in a moment. This is Mark and Denise in the Mornings, coming to you live from 860 AM, City of Philadelphia. Oh, boy, we've got quite a show lined up for you on today. If you want to be a part of the conversation, feel free to call in 888-329-3306. Again, that's 888-329-3306. We tend to keep it jam-packed with really good interviews, but this is still talk radio. So, again, if you want to be a part of it, feel free to call in to the show on this morning. And let us hear your thoughts as well. If you missed anything from earlier this week, go back and check out the podcast, iTunes, or at WWDBAM. Mm-hmm. And you can check us out there as well on the podcast. Yesterday, great interview with Boots Riley, writer and director of the new hit film, Sorry to Bother You. People are buzzing about it. If you haven't seen it yet, make sure you put that on your list to do this weekend. Let's go out and support Black filmmakers. And again, just it sounds, I mean, you know, Denise has seen it, so she can testify to it. I'm looking forward to seeing it later this weekend.
Oh, you should. And what I've been telling everybody is take some friends, because you're going to want to talk about this.
All right. So take some friends. And then so after you see the film, go up to Uncle Bobby's coffee shop in Germantown.
Exactly. Make a day of it.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that Mark is probably going to have something up there. I've got to check his calendar. But I'm sure he's going to have some kind of talk back or something about that film.
Mm-hmm. Because it's the kind of film that invites that kind of thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you can get a chance to hear from him directly by just checking out our podcast. He was actually in studio. And so, again, it's a great opportunity to hear it. Hey, tonight at the Dell, you know, Denise, that's who we should start like a summer segment.
Mm-hmm.
A spokesperson from the Dell to kind of promote and talk about the events. Because, man, let me tell you, the music on Thursday nights at the Dell in the summer, if you don't go, you are missing it. Tonight is gospel night. It's Tamela Mann. Sunday, Neo and Life Jennings. Man, Life is a beast in concert. Mm-hmm. I mean, he seems so laid back just listening to his music. I was surprised the first time we saw him. And then next week, Charlie Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tempted to go. Just because Tom Joyner says you can't leave this earth without seeing Charlie Wilson in concert. I haven't seen him yet.
Is he that good?
Listen, according to Tom Joyner, and I mean, look, Charlie Wilson is, at his age, listen to his schedule. Next week, he'll be here Thursday night, and then he goes to the next night, he does Cincinnati at their music fest.
Mm.
Yeah, the man is just, I don't know where he gets the energy.
Probably smoothies.
Smoothies. I doubt it, but okay.
Well, I'm just trying to find a nice positive, reason, because it could be any number of things. It could be smoothies. Right. It could be, any number of things. I'm just going to go with smoothies.
Gotcha. All right. Well, listen, today, so that's yesterday's show as well about Boots Riley. But today, later in this hour, we're going to speak to former mayor, the Reverend Wilson Good Sr.,
mm-hmm.
Mayor of Philadelphia, first African-American elected mayor, first black mayor of the city from 1984 to 1992, about his new book that has been released, Black Votes Mattered. And I think he actually said he's going to give us a few copies of those, too, to give out to listeners as well. We'll have to figure out how we're going to set that up.
Awesome.
You'll have a chance to get it. But among other topics, in addition to how does one become the first black mayor of Philadelphia, accomplishments in office and things of that nature, we're going to spend some time unpacking the controversial and devastating bombing of the Move House, which left numbers of people dead and others incarcerated. We'll talk about that moment and certainly the low point in that tenure. But he's open to have that conversation. So we know that Philadelphians still have a lot of strong feelings about it. And so you get a chance to hear that conversation and weigh in. It's also a reporter's roundtable today. And so we'll be speaking to one Mr. Ernest Owens and Christopher Flood, the drummer Norris, today about a number of very important Philadelphia local stories. So if you're not inside the city of Philly, you may not know all the nuance of these stories, but I guarantee you that they connect to places where you are around the country and around the world. I mean, the black experience in the diaspora, sadly, is almost the same no matter where you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you're in Philadelphia, whether you're in Bermuda, whether you're in Cape Town, Johannesburg, Kinston, these stories all seem to resonate. And so they're going to be talking about some of the more moving local stories. And of course, in this first half of the hour, we're going to talk to you about some of the big stories that are making the rounds right now.
Like how we have suddenly redefined no?
Yeah. You know, Sarah Sanders and Donald Trump, man, they are something else. They are something else, aren't they?
See, all you had to say was Sarah Sanders, and I already knew that anything that you said beyond Sarah Sanders was going to be some stuff that was going to – that you kind of know that that's the kind of stuff that April Ryan is sitting in the press, you know, in the press gaggle at the press, you know, at the press briefing, trying really hard not to roll her eyes. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders has kind of, you know, turned some of April Ryan's facial expressions into memes with the stuff she says.
Well, yesterday, add to April Ryan's list then, because yesterday – the president sitting in a meeting with the press took a few questions at the end. And one of the questions was, Mr. President, is Russia still trying to interfere with the elections? No. Okay. Follow-up question. No. And to which Sarah Sanders later said, when she met with the press separately, that's not what he meant. He meant no more questions. He meant no, press, get out of the room. That's what his no meant. Just like he didn't mean would, he meant wouldn't. When are you guys going to start listening? You have to understand how to listen to him. It's not what he says. It's the inflection, Denise. That's how you get to know what he actually means. He didn't mean no, Russia's not interfering. Of course they're interfering. He knows that. That's not what he meant. Why are you putting words in the president's mouth? Come on. Grow up, people.
I have never had a desire to work in a White House press office, because I'm sure that as jobs go, that's arduous and constant. And even if the president is somebody that's halfway trustworthy and stuff, it's a rough job, and I know for a fact I'd never want it. But this particular administration, I wouldn't want to work in its press office, because I would be deathly afraid that I would never be able to get another job anywhere else. And Fox can only take so many of these people. And Fox News can only take so many of these people. So, I sometimes sit and I look at these press conferences, and I think, instead of sending reporters, like seasoned journalists, to basically be lied to for an hour, this would be the perfect thing to send interns to. Every news organization, instead of putting, you know, the reporters that cover the White House in that press room, you know, and let them go out and find out, you know, what this administration is doing and that kind of thing. And let the interns sit through these press conferences so they get an idea of what it looks like when someone is insulting their intelligence. Because sometimes when you're a young journalist, you don't know when someone's insulting your intelligence. You don't know when someone is straight up lying to you and thinks that you're not catching it. I think that sitting down with, you know, in a press conference with Sarah Huckabee Sanders for like 45 minutes to an hour would give you a master class in what insulting your intelligence looks like.
Well, because they're doing a great job at it. No, you're right. They're doing a great job at it. So that's what's going on in the White House right now. Trust me, we can come back to some of that if we get a little bit more time. But I want to make sure we get some of the local stories that have just kind of broken loose this week that are also big. I mean,
we've been very busy.
Oh, by the way, just to show you, you know, Mayor Good, who we'll have on the show later, again, he's polarizing because on the one hand, here you have on social media interacting on our Facebook Live, you know, here's Asa Khalif saying he's a murderer. And on the other hand, there's Leslie Satchwell, one of our listeners in Florida, saying, I want one of his books. I mean, it's, you know, he was reelected after the MOVE bombing, by the way. That happened in his first year.
And I'm still trying to figure out how that happened.
So I'm just, right, well,
because
that's my,
usually
I'm just saying.
You don't get reelected after you blow up a city block. You
well,
just don't do that.
This is my point. And so it's so, you know, a lot of times political figures remain polarizing in that way. So so there you have it. On the one hand, here's Asa saying, boycott the book. And here's someone else saying, I want a book. And I'm sure that people will take the five copies that we receive from him, gladly take them and want them signed.
Oh, he's given us five.
So, yeah, I think that's what he told me. So, but here locally, Denise, and we can get to Trump in Montenegro tomorrow or later if we get a few extra minutes. But, I guess one of the big stories is this beef between our mayor, Mayor John Kenney, and the head of Roc Nation, Jay-Z.
See, one of the things that, and this is like one of the running jokes that, you know, the mayor and I have when he does press conferences and stuff. One of the things I always kind of pick on him about is Welcome America, the concert that we do on the Parkway on July 4th. And the fact that, you know, when he first became mayor, the first Welcome America concert he had, you know, I was like, I hope there's an ambulance nearby in case somebody, you know, has a heart attack because they did a dance move that might have worked for them 20 or 30 years ago, but doesn't necessarily work now. So I think that, you know, between kicking the roots to the curb, you know, and welcome, you know, for planning Welcome America, to now deciding that he's going to move Made in America Festival without telling anyone, or at least that's what, you know, the Roc Nation camp is saying. You know, you got to wonder, what is his beef with 21st century music, particularly 21st century music curated by, you know, folks in the hip hop community? I mean, it kind of just, and the thing is, Made in America, it may be annoying, it may drive people crazy, but it also brings money to the city. And the way that it was set up initially, at least when Michael Nutter, you know, told us all that they were allowing this festival to go on here, was that part of that money went to charity. Now, that was never really, we never really determined, you know, because the United Way, from what I understand, was the charity it was going to. And, you know, no one knew just how much money they got from that. But the thing is, Philadelphia, with all due respect, doesn't have a whole lot that's attracting young people to it. The X Games, you know, kind of were, you know, sent by the wayside. Forbes 30 Under 30 was one of the first casualties of the Kenney administration. There's not a lot that's bringing young people here. And you need to bring young people here.
But, Denise, okay, I'm with you there. But as a person who takes the commute that passes through Roc Nation's Made in America, mm-hmm. I will say, and I think I've said this on record before, probably last time this came up, I was still just doing a Friday night show. Mm-hmm. So I know that I've been one of the people who've been vocal that there's got to be a different venue unless they can figure out how to do it faster. So they use the same setup on the Ben Franklin Parkway that is used for Philadelphia's 4th of July celebration. Mm-hmm. But the 4th of July celebration does not shut down access to driving around until maybe a couple of days before. Then it alters it slightly. And then right after the 4th, it's back open. Everything. You can get around, and they're taking things up, you know. But I got to tell you that with Roc Nation, it's almost 2 weeks before the concert that it starts impacting traffic. And it lasts about 2 weeks afterwards. And what I can't understand is, why do you have to take up a month of my life and my daily commute? And so a lot of the complaints that the mayor has received, I have to imagine, are from people like me who are extremely annoyed and don't understand how we do major events on the Parkway all the time. And it's never that level of inconvenience. And so it's not just a weekend That's not it. I'm just telling you, as a person who has to pass it all the time or find a different way or take the Schuylkill, which, God, don't want to do that, or, you know, MLK, that it has a major impact. And so I think what should have been negotiated, if since the Parkway is so important to Jay-Z, he said it's important because he wants the Rocky Steps behind him. He wants that image. I get it. Okay, I get that. But, bruh, you got to be able to do it faster. The setup and breakdown time cannot have the kind of impact on the city that it has right now. So I think that that is a point of leverage and negotiation. But what I take issue with, Denise, is this. If, according to Jay-Z's open letter to the mayor, this op-ed, you can see it, it's in, you know, it's out there online. He claims that they paid about $3 million to the city in rent for the events.
Wow.
But he also, well, but that's over a number of years. It only breaks down to about $600,000 per event.
Mm-hmm.
And he also says that they gave almost the same amount of money to the United Way. So how is it that the part that you give to charity, United Way, is the exact same amount that the city receives in rent? I mean, it seems like there's some kind of unequal balance here. That, I mean, I'm not saying don't give to the United Way. They do good work, but it's our property. And if we're renting it and we're only charging 600 grand for an event that's raising millions of dollars, I think that the rent, especially given the impact that it has on the city, is not enough. We're not getting enough out of this arrangement. So I don't have an issue with, you know, making certain demands on Roc Nation. I do have an issue with how it was done. And I think that's the problem. You don't do somebody, you don't do someone like Roc Nation. You don't do business with anyone that way, that they find out in the press. Or that they find out, you know, in some other kind of way than you communicating to them directly. But you certainly don't do it to somebody like Jay-Z and Beyonce with all that's on the table.
Yeah, and page 6 on the New York Post said that, you know, basically this is Philadelphia's way of getting back at Jay-Z for his support of Meek Mill. Why must people keep bringing Meek Mill back into my life? I don't know. And I really don't think he has anything to do with this in particular. But
no.
To the folks who believe in conspiracy theories like this, that's what they're talking.
Well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, listen, it's let me tell you honestly what I really think it is. Now, this is my take. So once again, we see Mayor Kenney looking to be out of his league. That we have the city that wants to be first class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And great. Sorry, texting these. Okay. So yeah. So on the one hand, we have a city that wants to be, we want to compete with New York. We want to compete with Atlanta. We want to be viewed in the same conversation as Chicago, LA.
And we should be.
Well, right. By numbers we compare, by, you know, size of the city, economic engine, and all those things. But there is a reason that New York and DC, which were much smaller in scale to Philadelphia in the beginning of this country's forming. Philly was the city. But there's a reason why, in my opinion, that we have allowed those two cities on our southern and northern ends to just take off. And it's kind of like amateur hour, you know, that we don't, I mean, it's like you can't like create, you can't just have a simple deal with somebody who wants to come in and spend millions of dollars in your city. You can't figure a way to work that out.
Well, here's the thing. And, you know, in a way the way that a lot of our entertainment stuff is handled when it comes to stuff that particularly is, you know, directed at young people is anything that Michael Nutter did, it's like Jim Kenney is trying to undo when it comes to our entertainment options. Michael Nutter brought in the Roots to coordinate the Welcome America concert. He got rid of them. Michael Nutter brought Forbes 30 Under 30, the X Games, and different things like that. They are all gone. Michael Nutter brought in Made in America, and now it's gone. Or they're trying their hardest to, you know, make it so it does go away. And what people need to understand, because there was also some element, you know, one of the problems that we have with our mayors in Philadelphia is that some of them are petty. And what they need to understand is that being petty does not necessarily benefit the city. I understand that you may want to do things differently, but if something is actually working, leave it alone. Leave it alone and let it work. Because in the end, it benefits you if you just leave it alone and let it work.
But this is what I'm saying. So in a city like New York, right, you understand it's, you know, those mayors have a long history of working with people like a Jay-Z and like a Beyonce, and recognize that even though you may not even like the person, that you just, like you said, you leave it alone. It's making money. You know, if you have serious points of contention, like I said, the inconvenience on the city, you work that out and just insist that, look, you got to cut this down 2 or 3 days on either end of the event that's going to impact traffic. And other than that, it's got to be open and flowing, and you got to figure that out. And we got to talk about this rent. You're not paying enough. You need to pay more. And you get somebody in the room who can negotiate that. But I just think that it's, you know, I mean, I don't know, so much of what happens in the city, and it's not just this, it's the Amazon deal. It's, you know, so many other big issues that when these big things come to the city, that it seems to me that it's like, I don't know, maybe that sometimes I feel like Baby Huey, big in size, but that we don't have, that it's not all there, you know, up above the neck to kind of deal with the size that you have. And that's not necessarily slam against Mayor Kenney as much as it is just kind of a general statement of where the city is, that it's not ready for prime time. It wants to be.
Well, see, I disagree with you on that. In fact, I disagree with you strongly on that.
In what way? Please explain.
I think that Philly sells itself short all the time. And because it sells itself short, it does stuff like this. Because we are under this impression, because people keep telling us, oh, well, you're not good enough, you're not first class, you're not ready for prime time. So we don't want to go for anything. And when we do go for something and we actually achieve it, then there's this big sense of shock on the part of everybody, like, oh my God, that actually worked. It works because forgive me for how I'm going to put, this place is kind of badass. Really ticks me off to no end is when people fail to recognize that it is bad. It's a great city.
You're not hearing me. So then I'm sorry. Then let me try to articulate in a better way. So maybe it's on me, because I agree with you 100%. I love Philadelphia. I love living here, and I know that we have a lot to offer. So I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, people, friends of mine come here. This is the reason why so many transplants like ourselves, you know, Leslie and I, we didn't have to move into the city when I was sent to Mother Bethel. We could have stayed in our house in South Jersey, but we chose to move here, raise our kids here, send them to Philadelphia public schools, and totally embrace the city. So I am with you 100%. I'm sold. I'm saying that when I'm speaking to them, I'm talking about people who are in leadership who have to make these kind of decisions with the Jay-Z's of the world, that I'm talking about, like our elected representation. That's what I'm saying has not been up to the task. And I'm not just saying, so it's not just Kenny. It's not just the mayors, but it's, you know, council and it's everybody else that I think just sometimes miss and don't appreciate what you just said, that the city is tight and you don't have to give it away.
Well, that's
for people
true.
To want to be here.
I can't disagree with you on that.
Right. And that's all I'm saying. Listen, Jay-Z and Made in America is called, in basketball terms, an alley-oop. There's no way to mess it up. You know, it's like,
well, there wasn't until recently, but.
This is my point. There's no way to mess this up. It's already there. It's at the top of the rim. Literally, all you have to do is just tap it down and it goes in. But what do? You swat it away. And that's what I mean. It's like, yeah, it has issues. I'm telling you, I've got problems with some of the things about it. But there is a way you do it. And the way you do it is you start by sitting down and having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand. Jay-Z said in his op-ed that he's been trying for months to have a meeting with the mayor. And Jay-Z is saying he can't get a meeting with Mayor Kenney. Now, I've heard that from local activists and organizers, and people like black clergy people who have said that we've always had access to mayors. And I know personally it's taken me some time with power to have, you know, to have some meetings. I mean, I think we just got one a few months ago that we've been trying to have for a year and a half. So I thought it was just us. But I'm saying, my God, Jay-Z, does anybody not take Jay-Z's meeting?
Well, probably Donald Trump, although I would love to see that and I'd want the pay-per-view rights for it. Because there's some money that can be made.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. I just don't understand this. But it's symptomatic of a larger issue, and that it seems to me that our elected political class has to catch up to what the city has become.
To yeah.
Your point, this badass city that it needs elected leadership on all levels that matches what the city has become.
Yeah, it is kind of time to take that's the way we've always done it off of the city flag.
Yeah.
Because if I had a nickel for every time somebody has said to me, you know, that's the way we've always done it, when something has been done that has made me totally, you know, shake my head to the point where I have a migraine. They're like, but that's the way we've always done it. And it doesn't work. What are you doing?
Right. Right, right. So again, we will, we'll see, what happens of this, if they can somehow repair this problem. Got to think that there's got to be a way that they can, you know, work this out, but we shall see. Hey, Denise, we got a late breaking, guest who's coming in at 8 o'clock, Mensa Dean.
Yes, from the Philadelphia Daily News.
Great. And so thank you for working that out, because Mensa has written a timely piece on the shooting death of 14-year-old Tyree Banks, who was just murdered a couple of nights ago. He and some friends were shot in front of a house. It's a horrible story. But that's one of the things I want to talk about, that in connection to some of these other things as well, and kind of the lack of outrage that the community is displaying in this moment. But Mensa will be calling in at 8 o'clock. We do have a caller on the line who wants to weigh in on Made in America before we move off topic. Who we have, Denise?
Oliver from West Philadelphia.
Come on, Oliver.
Welcome to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Yeah, I feel that if he didn't feel that way, stay in New York. You've got the facilities still in New York. You got the Garden. You got the one in Brooklyn. You got the Yankee Stadium. I used to live in New York, so I can say that. And if he wants to stay in Philadelphia, then you got to go to Lincoln Financial Field or that other stadium. Why you have to crowd up the parkway all the time? People are tired of it. If I was living down there, I would be tired of it too. All that booming noise all night long. It's ridiculous. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oliver speaks for me. Denise, your commute doesn't take you that route.
Actually, yeah, it does. For me to get into the studio, I got to go right through that myself.
All right, so you haven't done it yet through MADE. We'll have this conversation. So you did it through the 4th of July. And then we're going to have the conversation after Labor Day.
Well, there's two lanes of the parkway that are closed right now for some sort of recreational thing that I had to get through a couple of days ago. And I'm like, okay, man. Well, what is this?
Well, listen, that's a whole – we could do a whole show on, you know, how many times our services at Mother Bethel are impacted by races that we don't even know about. Oh, it's a 3K that just happens to completely do a circle around your church and your people can't get in that Sunday. Sorry, we forgot to tell you. Huh? So, I mean, there's a whole different thing about how whoever it is that does this permitting kind of looks at the city and allows these things to happen. But Oliver, I think, again, speaks to – I think common sense says to most people – great. We'd love to have all these people come in the city. Labor Day weekend is dead. Take that entire area now down by the ballparks, that entire sports complex.
Okay,
man,
let me stop you right there. The Phillies and the Eagles will both be playing around Labor Day weekend. The Eagles will be starting their season. The Phillies will be finishing theirs up. So while
the Eagles
they'll
be in preseason.
Labor Day?
Preseason.
Labor Day? Are you sure about that?
The first game is not until the next weekend. Trust me.
Okay.
You're not going to have a, you're not, there won't, there will be no official, and I think the first game is probably that Thursday after Labor Day. But they never start before Labor Day. And so, but there will be preseason activity. But again, I'm saying that there's enough room down there that you could do a major festival
and
concert.
But here's the thing. As someone who used to live down there.
Yeah.
We're tired of it too. I remember when the Phillies were playing the World Series. There were people driving through my neighborhood backward and going the wrong way down one-way streets.
Guilty.
And I'm like, no. That's why when they were talking about putting the casino there, I'm like, do not put the casino there. Because quite frankly, we got enough crap. That section of South Philly has enough going on without adding anything else to it. And what really drives me nuts is that there's this willingness from the rest of this, on the part of the rest of the city, to just keep shoving stuff down there. That's not fair to those people that already have the Link and Wells Fargo Center and Citizens Bank Park and, you know, Xfinity Live, and they're going to put a casino there and all of that other stuff. I understand that it's convenient for everybody else in the city to basically cram all of our entertainment options into one small area, but you got to remember people live there too. And yeah, while they may not pay as much for their condos as they do on the parkway or somewhere else, these people have lives too, and their lives get disrupted every Sunday, every time the Phillies make the playoffs, or any time that someone's having a major concert. You know, show them some love too.
Okay. I mean, you know, you live, move near an airport, you're going to hear traffic above your head.
Mm-hmm.
You move near a ballpark, you're going to be impacted. I mean, you know, I'm just saying. So I just think that there are other places that this can go. And again, I'm not opposed to it staying where it is, provided that they do some things differently. And I think that is the part that they've not taken serious enough. Listen, in a few minutes, we're going to have former Mayor Wilson Good Sr., now Reverend Wilson Good Sr., on the line. And at 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to Mensa Dean about the shooting death of Tyree Banks at 14 years old here in the city, soon to turn 15. And there were several other people who were also shot who are now recovering. At 8:20, we'll speak to Christopher Flood, the drummer Norris, and Mr. Ernest Owens in Reporters Roundtable, and get from them their takes on what's happening. Also, well, Kenny took a hit yesterday about Jay-Z, but he also got a big win. So it's kind of, you know, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away day for him. Mm-hmm. Because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court backed the city of Philadelphia's sugary beverage tax and rejected the argument that it was a double tax on the people, given that the beverage suppliers have pushed the tax burden down onto the people of Philadelphia. And so for those who oppose the beverage tax, it was considered a loss. For people like Kenny, who have who didn't just support it, but campaigned on it and pushed it hard, this was a win for him. So I guess he had a good and bad day yesterday.
Yeah, it was some good news and some bad news. It's just the thing is, my hope is that now that the Supreme Court has weighed in and said that this tax is constitutional, that now now the Jeff Browns and BevTax opponents of the world will finally make the law do what it is supposed to do, which is the distributors are supposed to pay this tax. They are not supposed to pass it down. It's not supposed to impact consumers. It is a tax on distribution. And I'm hoping that now that the law has been found constitutional, whenever one of these distributors tries to make someone pass the tax on to consumers, I hope folks start getting fined, because that is what this is supposed to do.
But I guess here's the question. How could a ShopRite, since you called out Jeff Brown,
mm-hmm.
So how can Jeff Brown, if the distributor comes to him and says, well, I know that, you know, last week this Coca-Cola cost you $30. Mm-hmm. But because of this tax, it's now going to cost you 40. Mm-hmm. So what is his recourse? What can he, I mean, because you're right. The tax was not supposed to. So the local retailers, the bodega shop owners, I mean, even places like the churches that have vending machines with soda. Right. I mean, all of us who have to, you know, now pay this tax. If they're charging the local stores and people who are going to then turn around and retail these sugary drinks, who did they turn to? Who fights against that and makes sure that those prices remain the same as they were before the tax started?
Well, that's on the city. The city should have an enforcement thing that makes people have to pay some sort of fine or be somehow cited for not following this law. Or you could just say to the distributor, okay, well, according to the law, I'm not supposed, my consumers are not supposed to have to pay this. So, you know, eat it.
Well, right now they're not. And so that's...
That's because no one's making them enforce it. That's what's got to happen. What folks have got to do is go to city council and say, look, while now that this tax has been found constitutional and it is the law of the land, you need to put together some sort of an enforcement arm to make sure that it doesn't impact consumers. They can do that. You know, it's just a matter of will. They can do that.
Well, right now they're not. And I think that if they had done that in the beginning, then they probably would have had very little opposition from almost anybody except the people who, you know, I guess are like actually selling the beverages who are going to have to eat that tax themselves. But because they have it, you know, this is kind of where we are right now.
Well, maybe where we are right now, but since the Supreme Court has spoken, folks need to get on their job.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't expect that this is going to die anytime soon and that people are going to continue to fight it. I mean, I still continue to say it's a regressive tax and that it goes back to what we were just talking about having, you know, Philadelphia elected leadership that understands what you have. See, if you understand the value of the object that you possess, then you don't undersell it. And I think that there's a lot of money left on the table. And so as a result of not fully appreciating what we have and maximizing the gift that is this city that is on the northeast, in the middle of the northeast corridor on 95, easily accessible, great airport, all of those things, we don't maximize the revenue side. And so what do? Then we have to keep looking for different ways. You know, first is the beverage tax. Now it's a proposal to raise property taxes again, and soon it'll be a tax on something else. That you don't have to tax your way out of this. You have a great asset. What we need is some more creativity on thinking on the income side of how do we get more money for this beautiful asset that we have that's called Philadelphia. And the burden does not have to then fall on the people who live here. You can't keep taxing the same people over and over again, even if you call it something different. Just can't do it. Can't do it.
Okay.
So listen,
but,
we've got.
But it's not supposed to be so taxing got, us, but hey.
All right. Well. Speaking of a person who is very familiar with this, I'm sorry to have you waiting there, Mr. Mayor. I'm not in the studio, and my messenger's coming in a little slow. But we have a former mayor who had to wrestle with all of these issues. He probably even has some thoughts about this, about, you know, how do we get more without taxing the people of Philadelphia? Maybe he can answer that too. But he's actually on the line to talk about his book. And his time as mayor, he is now an ordained minister, the Reverend Wilson Good Sr., first African-American mayor in the history of Philadelphia. And Mr. Mayor, we want to thank you for taking time to come on this morning to Mark and Denise in the mornings. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And thank you so much for this opportunity just to spend some time with you on the book.
So your book is Black Votes Mattered, A Philadelphia Story, and it's also available on Amazon, and I even see it's already on Kindle as well. So Mr. Mayor, let's talk about it. And if you don't mind, let me just kind of take you back for a moment. Nobody, you know, no one exists in a vacuum. And so clearly there were people who were before you who had attempted to run for mayor, to be the first black mayor. Can you kind of just take us back for a moment and talk about the political landscape? Who were some of the pioneers and trailblazers that even made it possible for you to have a successful run?
The book outlines that we have to go back to Octavia Cato, and we have to go back to the PTC workers in the 1940s, and we have to go back to the Home Rule Charter in the city where two African Americans were elected in 1950, Raymond Pace Alexander and Marshall Shepard Sr. And we have to go back to Leon Sullivan in 1960 and 400 black ministers, and to Cecil B. Moore and his marching around Girard College wall until they admitted black students. All those things are connected to what happened in 1968 when Martin Luther King died, was shot and killed. And in Philadelphia, there was a group organized called the Black Political Forum. But a year before that, three African Americans ran for mayor. They were Leonard Smalls, Cecil B. Moore, and a real estate broker at 52nd and Arch Street by the name of Leonard Roberts. And then Hardy Williams, John White, and myself organized a group called the Black Political Forum because we felt that it was time for African Americans to select their own candidates. And Hardy Williams ran in 1970 based upon our organization and was the first African American in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to be elected without being handpicked by the white power structure. 2 years later, David P. Richardson, at 22 years of age, ran and was elected state representative. Dave Richardson defeated a white opponent. In 1975, Charles Bowser ran for mayor under the Philadelphia Party banner and was able to defeat the Republican candidate for mayor in that general election, and of course was defeated by Frank Rizzo. In 1979, Charles Bowser ran again and came within 30,000 votes of defeating Bill Green for mayor, and then of course. The handwriting was on the wall then, and then when Bill Green was actually elected, Sam Evans, a powerful figure in Philadelphia, C.D. Lewis, Tucker, and Charles Bowser went to Bill Green and said to him, we're not going to support you in the general election unless you appoint an African-American as manager and director for the city. And Bill Green did that, and I was the beneficiary of that. I was the first African-American managing director for the city, and because of my visibility, when Bill Green decided not to run in 1982 for mayor in 1983, then I decided that I was going to run and was elected. That's the kind of history and landscape that took place at that time. And the book was written because I think that people need to know that history. People need to be able to go somewhere and look and understand that all of this is just not just dropped out of the sky. It was not something that just came down and it happened. There was a long process. A lot of people had pieces of it that made it possible for the first African-American mayor to be elected in 1983.
Yeah. Who were some of the women? Because, you know, obviously the men are remembered because they were the ones out front running for office in those days, especially in those earlier days. But I have to imagine that there were a lot of women who were also who were out there pushing and clearing the trail that made this possible.
I think that no one can talk about this without talking about C. DeLores Tucker, who became in the early 1970s the Secretary of the Commonwealth, but also prior to that was a major political figure in Philadelphia. And the interesting thing also in terms of another woman, which was Ethel Allen, who was supported by the Black political reform in 1971 in the mayor's election when Frank Rizzo ran and Harley Williams ran and Bill Green ran, but she ran on the Republican ticket in the 5th District in North Philadelphia and defeated a man by the name of Thomas McIntosh. And C. DeLores Tucker was also in the room with Sam Evans and Charles Bowser when, in fact, they confronted Bill Green and said, you have to appoint an African-American as managing director for the city of Philadelphia. So I wanted to say that, but may I just also add that another purpose of this book is really to make the point in the days of watching Donald Trump, who is bigger than life in so many ways, and we had our own Donald Trump in Philadelphia. His name was Frank Rizzo, and Frank Rizzo was a police commission two-term mayor, and I ran against him in the primary election of 1983. And the point which I make to people all the time that when you run a campaign to win, it's not about popularity. It's about voter turnout. And you only defeat a bigger-than-life opponent, a bigger-than-life candidate, you only defeat them basically by out-organizing them and turning out your base of support on Election Day. The biggest issue that Hillary Clinton had, and I know people can talk about Russia involvement in it and all the thing, but she had the ability to win the election against Donald Trump and failed to turn her base of support out in key precincts and key areas of the country in upstate Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Wisconsin. And so those are the things that the book tried to explain, and that is that if you're going to win an election, you have to be able really to go out and turn your base of support out. What I knew when I started running for mayor that I had to get equal turnout of Black voters in Philadelphia. And that's why the book is called Black Voters Matter, an equal turnout of Black voters to Rizzo base. Rizzo had won in 1971 and 1975 because his base of support was more passionate. And the Northeast and the River Wards turned out in a 2-1 over North Philadelphia and West Philadelphia and Northwest. And therefore, that formula never wins. It never wins when you may not have all the support in the polls, but when the election day comes around, if your base of support turns out at a ratio of 2-1 over who is favored to win, you don't win. And so I was able to defeat Frank Rizzo basically by organizing a campaign that essentially turned out my base of support equal to that of Frank Rizzo. And I was able to get 98% of the Black vote and 15% of the white vote. And that was a formula for winning. And so I guess the point of the book is that if we're going to defeat in the future candidates like Frank Rizzo or like Donald Trump, what we have to do is turn the base of support out who do not agree with their policy and do not agree with their philosophy. And if we don't do that, if we stay at home and say that our vote don't matter, it's not going to ever happen.
Now, Reverend Good, it would kind of be an act of journalistic malpractice if I didn't ask you about because you're talking about voting and how, you know, important it is to turn out your base. Your base came out for you shortly after the MOVE bombing. And you still have a lot of folks in the African American community who are really mad at you about that. So I'm wondering how did you manage to get your base to come out in light of that? Because, you know, for a lot of people, you know, they kind of saw, no matter what you felt about MOVE, you had a lot of black people who felt that you had basically attacked your own community and wondered why they should support you.
Well, I think that number one, that the fact that people came out and voted for me in spite of defeating Edmund Dell in the primary election. I defeated Edmund Dell in the primary election after MOVE, and they ran tons of ads about MOVE, and I defeated Frank Rizzo again in the general election, and they ran tons of ads. I think that let me say a couple things, if I could. One is that people who know me know that after the MOVE situation in 1978, and that when I became manager and director of the city, that against the wishes of Mayor Green, that I helped relocate those persons from the Fulton Avenue house in 1978. That's never mentioned when people talk about MOVE, and MOVE members will tell you that I worked on their behalf and got them housing. The second thing that I would say is that people who know me. I was not a Johnny come lately to the political scene. I had worked in communities. I had built 2,000 housing units for churches in the city and the suburbs between 1968 and 1978. So I am a known entity. I'm not someone that just appeared on the scene. At that point, I was active in church. I was chairman of the digging board in my church. I spoke at churches when I was chairman of the PUC. I was a chair of the PUC when Three Mile Island took place. But let me come back to focus on your question. There's no one who knows me who believed that I would order, as the paper has said consistently, ordered the bombing of a house with children in it. So I wanted to say that's not what happened. And in fact, it was not the dropping of the device on the roof of the house that caused the problem. It was the stupidity of the police commissioner and the fire commissioner for not putting the fire out when they could have put it out. If you remember that when you go back and look at what happened, that the fire was very small when it started, and I was in my office downtown with Karen Warrington just shouting, "Put the fire out, put it out." And they did not do that, and communication being what it was in 1985, I was simply not able to communicate with anyone on the scene because of whatever, because we didn't have the ability to text, we didn't have the ability to use our cell phones as we did now. We had beepers at that time, and we were trying to communicate in that regard. So having said all of that, let me just say this. I own what happened on Osage Avenue. I appointed the fire commission. I appointed the police commissioner. I appointed also the managing director. They're all my appointees. I made a terrible mistake in appointing Gregor Sambor as police commissioner. None of this would have happened had he not had this idea to do something which was stupid, which was drop the device from a helicopter on a roof. But even more devastating than that was the fact that they stood by and watched the fire burn. So what I would say is that I've never tried to walk away from that, but people continue to support me even today. And I've traveled all across the country in all 50 states working on behalf of children of prisoners. And the MOVE incident came up once in my travel. And as I go around the city, people know who I am and what I do. So I don't try and disown my relationship and to MOVE. I simply say that I'm not going to permit anyone at any time to judge me based upon one day in my life. I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to stop working on behalf of people, on behalf of children, on behalf of getting better condition for people, and I will continue to do that. And so that's my response to your question.
So Mr. Mayor, so you're saying then that on the day of the bombing, that so the police commissioner acted on his own in dropping the device, and that you didn't give them the okay for it.
I did not know that they were going to drop a device from a helicopter. I knew that they were going to try and remove the bunker from the roof for their safety. I did not know and did not understand that the way they were going to do that was dropping a device on the roof of the house.
Yeah. All right. Well. Listen, we're well past our 8 o'clock break here, but we do want to at least appreciate you willing to talk about this because, again, this is, you know, one of the things that's been on the mind of a lot of people. And as you know, regardless of what you just laid out, that this remains controversial and that as a result, people either love you or, you know, or not. But there's a lot of polarization around it. And the MOVE bombing continues to be a part of this city's not just history, but the current moment. But I guess you can learn more about that and other things in the new book, Black Voters. And I'm sorry, I kept saying Black Votes, but I think it means so much more. Black Voters Mattered. A Philadelphia Story, written by former Mayor Wilson Good Sr. And you can pick that up on Amazon or in bookstores as well. And I'd have to say that that title should also say to many of us, Black voters still matter. And we've got an election coming up in 2018, so let that resonate and sit in with you. Reverend Good, thank you for taking time out to come on this morning and your willingness to talk about everything that we laid out for you. And we appreciate your time today. Best with the book.
Thank you so much. And I'm always transparent.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Bye.
Thank you so very much. That is the Reverend Wilson Good Sr. We got to take a quick station identification break. And when we come back, we'll speak with Mensa Dean from the Philadelphia Daily News.
WWDB Philadelphia, 860 AM.
You're listening to Mark and Denise in the Morning on 860 AM WWDB, a part of Beasley Media. Mark and Denise in the Morning is a product of Tyler Made Media, LLC.
Got to give the people
right. Welcome back to Mark and Denise in the Morning. This hour is brought to you by Power. Philadelphians organized to witness, empower, and rebuild. Power is the region's leading faith-based organizing effort involved in the fight for fair, adequate education funding, a 21st century livable wage, reform and transparency in the criminal justice system, climate justice, protecting voting rights, pushing for voter engagement, trying to get people out to the polls, and all of that. Learn more about the work of Power in the city, in the suburbs, across the center of the state, as far up as Lehigh Valley, far west as Harrisburg, and a little bit beyond. Learn more about that work at powerinterfaith.org. Shout out to a good friend and brother, Reverend Greg Holston, executive director, who sat in for me on last week. Show is also brought to you by Joel Wilson and the good people of JCW Computer Consulting. You can find them at jcwcc.com. Denise?
Yes.
All right. Have to unpack that later. We're jammed. I mean, you know, I think that the bottom line is folk who are with you beforehand are going to probably still be with you. Folk who are not buying it, who weren't buying it before, probably don't buy that.
No.
But I, you know, but I mean, listen, you know, it's, yeah, well, okay.
I just kind of want to know, these are people you hired to do a job.
Yeah.
And you're going to tell me, and this, and he's been very consistent about this, mm-hmm. over the years, you're going to tell me that despite the fact that these were your employees, you didn't know that they were trying to get rid of this bunker by dropping a bomb on it?
Yeah, well, that's what he said.
Okay. So. Well, to quote Jay-Z, who we've been talking about, you know, a lot this morning, I don't believe you. You need more people.
Oh, my God. Rock Nation. In all kind of airtime today. Well, let's move on. Let's move on. One of the stories that's happened this week that is not getting enough press, in my opinion, while we have rightfully been focused on the stabbing death in Rittenhouse Square and what's happening with the suspect Michael J. White and the family of the victim, Sean Schellinger. Another story happened this week involving teenagers, four teenage boys who were shot, and I think an adult as well, one fatally so. Tyree Bates, I think I said Banks earlier, but Tyree Bates, 14, soon to be 15. And as I was thinking about this story, Denise, I was thinking, you know, too bad for these kids that they weren't shot by a white person.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because if they were shot by a white person, we'd all know about them by now. And Tyree Bates would have a protest in his honor. And we'd be demanding justice and that the two people who shot him would be found. But right now, nobody really seems to care because presumably he was shot by somebody black.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just says something, you know, about the, you know, it does say something about people who are critical of us in this moment that, you know, that some things rile us up and others are just kind of like, okay, keep it moving. So one of the persons who's writing about this is our friend, Mensa Dean from Philadelphia Daily News, and his article caught my eye this morning. So I want to thank him for accepting our invitation at the last minute to come on. Mensa, welcome to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So no problem. So Mensa, tell us about Tyree. Who was he? And tell us about his neighborhood, his family, his friends.
Well, he was one of five people who was shot early Monday, or I guess it was around midnight, Monday going into Tuesday, in North Philadelphia, 4th and Susquehanna, the 2100 block of 4th Street. 14-year-old kid, he would have been 15 next month, and he and three other teens and a 24-year-old man were shot by two gunmen. Police have no description no names of the gunmen, and they just opened fire on these two, four people. And the man was actually hit, but they believe by a stray bullet. He was not the intended target. But the police believe that for some reason, these four teens may have been the target of the gunmen. They were out front in a house in a residential area, and Tyree was hit in the forehead by a bullet and died. And the other three teens sustained superficial wounds. That I believe they're all out of the hospital now. And the 24-year-old man also is, recovering well. The area is, it's North Philadelphia. I was asking people, like, what do you call this place? I asked the homicide captain, John Ryan, what's the name of this neighborhood? He said the 26th Police District. And so that wasn't very helpful. But it's a part of North Philadelphia. It's represented by City Councilwoman Quiñones Sanchez. Very close to Gerald Clark's district. That's all we know. We don't know who these gunmen were. We don't know what the motive was. But we know that one's dead and four are injured.
Wow. So,
yeah.
So one of the parts that stuck out to me about your story was his brother. And I guess it was his little brother who was, waiting for him to come home. I know that writing stuff like that often makes me feel like I need to go sit in a dark room somewhere. Covering, stuff like that, tell me a little bit about this young man and whether or not, was how he felt like really, really apparent to you? And
what we haven't been able to speak to his mother.
Okay.
So we don't know much about him.
Okay.
We did speak to the brother that you're referring to,
mm-hmm.
who had you made that remark that he felt that what had happened was like a dream, and mm-hmm. he was hoping that his brother would really come home. A community mentor who I interviewed, a man named Sean Banks, he runs a program called Phillywood. He's also an entertainment producer. He's working on a reality show. He is the one that relayed to me what the brother had said at the Tuesday vigil about him, about the brother of the dead young man, feeling like what had happened was a dream, and he was hoping that his brother would come home. Both brothers were mentored by this man, Sean Banks, and they in basketball and in other, programs in that community. And, we know that they don't have any type of criminal record. They're not, there's nothing, the police said they have no, history or knowledge of these young men who were shot, which makes it more puzzling, like why two gunmen would open fire on them. Sometimes when young people are the targets of violence, it's because of, the lifestyles that they're living, So this is really very puzzling because these kids were not known to law enforcement, as they say. They were just kids in their neighborhood on a hot summer night. So, but we know that he liked to play basketball, Tyree. We know that he had just graduated from McKinley Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
He was very well respected. In fact, there were more than a dozen teachers from McKinley at the vigil that took place on Tuesday, early evening. And, so there were more than 100 people there, close to probably 200 actually. And so probably 12 to 14 teachers from McKinley did show up. So we know he was very respected. And, mm-hmm. They're very, the neighborhood's taking it hard.
See, that's my point. So you're not talking about a young man who seems to have brought this upon himself by the way he was living. By all accounts, like you said, this is a stray bullet, probably not even intended for him. shot and killed right in his prime, 14, about to turn 15. You know, you have teachers coming out. You have mentors coming out. You know, this is not your typical, you know, kid shot in the hood kind of story. And yet, for some reason, there is no outrage, which to me is outrageous. That, you know, that there's more outrage about a 14-year-old arrested unjustly at the zoo, which is also a terrible story, than about this 14-year-old shot and killed in his own neighborhood sitting in front of a house on a summer night. And I just think that this is just, you know, just speaks to this frustration that, you know, it seems like it has to fit a certain narrative to warrant our anger.
You know, well, that's a good point, you know, because a similar crime happened in Washington, D.C. also on Monday. Five people were shot by four gunmen at a public housing project, and five were shot and one died, and the one who died was a 10-year-old girl. And the video of the shooting shows that the gunmen weren't shooting at anyone in particular, because there was four gunmen who got out of a car, out of all four doors of the car, and they shot in the direction that they got out of. And police believe that they just shot up the neighborhood because they have a rivalry with guys from that neighborhood. But the people they shot weren't the guys they're beefing with. And so after that happened, the mayor of Washington, D.C. and other politicians came to the scene. The mayor has been tweeting about the incident. And that struck me because I thought, wow, our mayor and our police commissioner did not go to the scene. And I actually put that into my story, but it was taken out last night because the editors felt that we were holding our public officials to a standard that they aren't normally held to, because it's not expected of the mayor and the police commissioner to go to a crime scene on a regular basis, they said. But I just felt that this wasn't a regular crime. You have five people shot, and it's just so, you know.
Okay. So let me get this straight. Your editors believed that you were holding the police commissioner and the mayor of Philadelphia up to a standard that they're not usually asked to meet in terms of going out to a crime scene where five people, including an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, were shot to death.
That's right. Well, just a 14-year-old was shot to death. 11-year-old was shot. 14-year-old was shot. 15-year-old was shot. 24-year-old was shot. Yeah, that's what I was told. I was told that they said they don't normally, you know. And so I thought, wow, you have a mirror situation in a city just down 95. Five people shot. Five people shot. One's dead. It's a child. You know, and the response in D.C. was just different. It was entirely different. I mean, the mayor was out there. The police commissioner was out there. Other elected officials were out there. The mayor's of Washington's name is Muriel Bowser. If you look at her Twitter account, she's been tweeting about this shooting, and our police department didn't even tweet about this.
Do you think it's because there seems to be this perception that, you know, people are getting shot to death every night around here?
I don't know. I mean, the police tweet about pickpockets. You know, they tweet about just every crime that they have a picture of somebody. And this is five people being shot. And I was just stunned that as of Wednesday night, our police department had not even had put up a tweet about this shooting at 4th and Susquehanna. And, you know, the mayor's office told me, well, he just got back into town from Quebec yesterday. But I said, did someone from his office go to the scene? And they said, no one from his office went. Commissioner Ross was not there. So I just thought that, you know, I put that in there, you know, and my editors took it out. But, you know,
Reverend, when you
said you felt that it's not getting the attention, the shooting's not getting the attention that it would have gotten if these people had been shot by someone white, I guess we were sort of on the same wavelength, you know, when I put that in the story.
That's not a good look. I'm sorry. Well, no. If five people can get shot up in your city and it doesn't even, you know, get an acknowledgement from your police department, that's not a good look.
But Denise. It's the wrong five people who got shot.
No five people should get shot.
No, no. No. See, yeah. if the five people who got shot were near my church in Society Hill, or if the five people who got shot were in Rittenhouse Square or in one of these gentrified neighborhoods, if they were five newcomers in Point Breeze or five people in Northern Liberties or five people off of Spring Garden in Fairmont, if the right five people had been shot and one killed, trust me, you wouldn't have to tell the mayor to go see them. You wouldn't have to tell the commissioner to tweet about it and to do everything you can to find the suspects. But unfortunately for these five, they're the wrong five people. And so nobody gives a damn.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But we're trying to do our part by writing about it and keeping them, because the gunmen are still out there. And so people need to be very aware that if they know something, they should report it to the police.
Wow. Well, Bensa, listen, we appreciate you writing it. And, because again, had you not written it, we wouldn't have reached out this morning, and who even knew that part? I think that even what your editor said is symptomatic of the larger issue and the lack of concern that's just throughout the city. So please continue to write about it and let us know if there are any updates, especially if the suspects are found or if there's a development in the case. All right.
I sure will.
Thanks. Thanks. That's Mensa Dean, Philadelphia Daily News. Denise.
Thank you.
You ever had hey, Denise, you ever had an editor do that to you?
I think every reporter in America has had an editor do that to them. I think, especially since now there's this sensitivity to what gets in the paper because of advertising and the fact that advertising isn't what it used to be. You're afraid of losing anybody. And while, you know, I understand that that's, you know, important to make sure that, you know, the way that you pay your people is still maintained. The thing is, you know, that's an important part of the story. The fact that, you know, and it goes back to, you know, that's the way we've always done it. And, you know, because, you know, the folks in Washington, you know, they have a pretty busy city, too. And, you know, the fact that the mayor and the you know, police department has taken the time to actually acknowledge that, you know, this happened and it was bad, you know, that's important, because it makes the community think that, hey, you're paying attention to us and to what's happening to us. And, you know, if you're not paying attention to us and what's happening to us, then we start to feel like we don't matter. And, you know, there are enough opportunities, you know, for folks in this city to feel like they don't matter, you know, without, you know, not even acknowledging the fact that, you know, five people, several of them children, were shot and that one is dead.
Again, I say, they just happen to be the wrong five. If they were different five people, we'd all know their names. In fact, I mean, you know, think about this for a moment. So five, you know, kids are shot. Well, four kids and a 24-year-old. And I'm at an age now where I can actually say he's like a kid,
well,
too.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, you know.
Right. So five young people shot, one fatally so. And the one who's fatally killed is, by all accounts, an upstanding young person, not involved in anything. His teachers come out to the vigil, his mentors at the vigil. People pour out in support, you know, and we don't know about them. And yet, four people who were trying to buy weed in Bucks County, who were murdered by the guy they're trying to buy weed from in a drug deal gone bad. Remember this now. They were out trying to buy drugs. Right. Now, again, no matter what you think about, you know, I'm just saying, though, you know, that here they are, four white guys trying to buy drugs in Bucks County, killed by Cosmo DiNardo. And a year later, did you see the printed story? I know I talked about this last week, but in the mm-hmm. printed version of the same newspaper company mm-hmm. that told Mensa, you can't put this part in the editorial about the mayor not showing up, it's not fair, mm-hmm. gave each of the four murder victims a full page, an entire page in the paper devoted to their story. Not just one page about the entire, each of the victims who, again, were out trying to buy weed, right? And I'm not trying to throw dirt on them, but I'm just telling you this is how it is. And yet here are these victims, including a boy who, you know, shot dead with a stray bullet, probably was going to make something of his life, and is, doesn't fit the right narrative. Wrong victim. Wrong assailant. Just doesn't fit, you know, what we want to push out there. There's something wrong with that.
Well, that's why we have the Reporters Roundtable, so we can discuss issues like that.
Man, I'm just like, really, I'm sorry. This is just I didn't anticipate Mensa saying that, and it just really just sent something, you know, off. So I'm sorry. You're right. So listen, we got join us today in the Reporters Roundtable to carry us the rest of the show today. Two people who are no strangers to the program, both of them good friends of ours. Christopher Flood, the drummer Norris, who is also CEO of TechBook Online. Mm-hmm. And Flood, the drummer, was our partner when we started out this morning, venture off on a different station. And it's always good to talk to Flood. Christopher Flood, the drummer, welcome back to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
I think he got cut off.
Oh, after that great introduction?
Yeah, but hopefully he'll call back in.
He did that because he wants me to do it again. All right, while we're waiting on Flood to get back on the line, we also have with us no music this morning, but he's our Monday morning segment. He's the pinch hitter who carries us home every Monday, Mr. Ernest Owens. You can find him on Twitter at Mr. Ernest Owens, award-winning journalist as well, and CEO of Ernest Media Empire. Ernest, what's up on this Thursday?
I'm here for that lovely introduction. It's been great. I'm looking forward to, you know, this conversation and just the 2 weeks, because I'm going to Detroit for the National Association of Black Journalists Convention, and I am lit and I'm ready to go.
All right. And listen, we've got Flood, the drummer, back on the line. Flood, you back there with us?
Yep.
There you go.
It's official now. He's on the air because we heard a yerp.
There you go. And in addition to what we said about Flood, you can also find him on Twitter at Flood the Drummer. Let me just tell you, you want to follow both of these young men, Flood and Ernest, because I'm going to tell you, in their Twitter feeds and on Facebook and all their social media, they're going to keep you up to date on the big stories and also stories that you don't know, which is why we wanted to have them on today. So go ahead, Denise, lead us in this Reporters Roundtable.
Well, I guess we should start by kind of, you know, backtracking a little bit on the story that we were just talking about. There were five people shot, including a 14-year-old boy was killed as part of that. And what Mensa Dean from the Daily News was telling us is that in D.C., when, you know, a similar thing happened, the mayor and the police commissioner got involved, and the coverage reflected that. But in this particular case, I mean, when Mensa mentioned that in his story, his editor took it out. And while I can understand, you know, maybe why, you know, the editor might have taken it out for reasons of objectivity or perceived objectivity, The thing is, you know, the reason why they took it out was because they said that the mayor and the police commissioner weren't expected to show up at crime scenes like that. What do you, in your reporting, have you come across stuff like that? And, you know, what do you think, you know, that, you know, you're basically being told this isn't, you know, something that the mayor and the police commissioner should be expected to, you know, acknowledge?
Yeah, let's start with
For me,
Flood.
You know,
go ahead,
know reporting in the newsroom. Yeah, reporting in a newsroom kind of like Philadelphia Magazine. I mean, I haven't really had any, problems with it. I mean, I kind of just, that's actually when I heard that, I was like, that's kind of bizarre. And, you know, again, everybody's interpretation is what it is, and it's about what kind of argument you can make. I would say for every article that I write, there's nothing that goes out that I don't see before it goes out. There's nothing taken out that I don't know is being taken out. And there's a discussion about everything that we discuss. I have to feel comfortable putting it out there because at the end of the day, my name's on it. So whatever happens, you know, I have to feel comfortable with that. Everything from the title, the byline, any paragraph, any phrase, I have to approve on it before it goes out on my end, because I told, you know, what people don't understand with reporters and editors, that an editor, you know, if they're doing their job right, people don't really know they're behind the scenes. The person that gets the heat, good or bad, success or not, is the writer who has the byline. And so my whole agreement and my relationship with my editors has always been that, you know, whatever ideas you have, we're discussing it. And what happens, you know, I have to be able to look at that and understand why I feel comfortable with it. But as far as that goes with things like that, I haven't had any situations like that in my thing. They may say, can you clarify this a little more for people who may not understand it your way to have that, I guess. I don't really believe in the term objectivity in journalism because that doesn't really exist. But it, I guess you can say fairness. It would have probably been, okay, if you're going to note that he wasn't, they weren't at the scene, you need to back that up by with context of, like, unlike other cities like D.C. and whatnot who have had similar cases, the mayor for what did not attend. And then, you know, if there's a statement from the mayor's office that could, you know, can accompany why they didn't or what the case may be, provide that. But as far as just not, just taking it out and not really having a true conversation or letting that person have it, that I haven't had that experience, and I hope not to. But you know, that just, yeah. You know, this is silly.
So Flood, you are, so with TechBook Online, you're the CEO, and so you have control over the content. So it's probably you've not run into that. But how are you processing the coverage of this shooting? Because I know this is something that you and I have had a lot of, you know, conversations about, the way in which shootings like this don't enrage people. But, mm-hmm. you know, had the shooter been white of these five people right now, we'd all be on that corner. We'd know exactly where these kids lived, and there'd be coverage, you know, until the cows come home about this story.
Yeah, so I guess there's two things. One, I just wanted to just touch back on what Denise said before I touch your point, Mark, is that no one had the expectation of what the editor said. No one had the expectation that the mayor or the police commissioner would go there. And I think that statement is emblematic of the Philadelphia problem, is that there are very low expectations of the politicians in this city. Mm-hmm. When you think about the Australian woman who was killed by the Somalian police officer in the Midwest, you saw the mayor cry. You saw the police commissioner offer to resign, right? And this was almost juxtaposed to when David Jones was killed, and you could barely get a word out of either one of the city officials here. I think particularly with the commissioner here, Richard Ross, he's very reclusive. And I just had a conversation yesterday with one of his associates where we were just kind of comparing notes about why he is so or seemingly withdrawn from the public. I mean, you know, you would think that you'd have a press conference at the beginning of the summer with both the mayor and the police commissioner saying, look, we understand how cold it gets when it gets hot. We are committed to having a safe summer. Here's the city's plan for violence reduction. We don't even know what that plan is other than rec centers, right? And trying to get taxes to pay for rec centers so kids have somewhere to go. Other than that, I don't know what the violence reduction strategy is in the city. But to your point, Rev, about the outrage, the same night on Tuesday when the vigil was being held for these young men, Ike Raw and I were at a meeting in South Philadelphia put on by Moms Bonded by Grief, and it was packed with at least 50 women, mothers, all 90% of whom had lost their children to violence, and they were outraged. They were outraged at the shooting at Dwarf in Susquehanna. They were outraged at what happened to their children, many the killers of whom are still on the street. But I think the point goes back to the media. There was no media there. And so I think that it has to be the right narrative for the mainstream media to care, and it has to be the right victim. And when you're poor and black, they're not the right victim. It doesn't make for a great story because it's so redundant, they feel.
Wow. I guess, okay, I'm rarely speechless, but that kind of left me speechless.
And I would just add though, I agree with everything you just laid out, Flood, but I would just add that it seems like it has to be the right narrative for us to care.
Of course.
Yeah. That's
the part that bothers me. That, I mean, okay, so Yeah, I mean, it does not seem like many of us really care that a 14-year-old was shot and killed. If it had been, I don't know, you know, like the son of some celebrity in the city, then we would all been, you know, concerned and outraged. If it had been, you know, some, you know, white kid who was shot and killed in a neighborhood where, quote unquote, this doesn't happen here, you know, but it just seems like, you know, hey, Tyree Bates, you know, add him in with that, just dump that body on the rest of the bodies.
Wow.
And I just think that's a statement about us.
I think it goes back to expectations. People have an expectation that police officers will keep them safe and that they will have some restraint when encountering someone where they won't use their gun. Whereas in certain communities, violence is expected and it's part of the culture. And so people become desensitized to it. It becomes normal to them. Whereas a police killing, they consider abnormal. And so it does elicit a different type of response, whether it's correct or not, right? I mean, where the last time I was on the show, we talked about Pittsburgh and why no one was focusing on the fact that what preceded that officer involved shooting was a drive-by by black people, likely on black people.
Yep, pretty much.
I don't know what the next topic is, but I was going to say that, you know, I think for me it's, you know, you was asking the question, why do other black people don't tend to care about these issues? It's because, to be quite honest, I mean, you have to go back to the politics of it all. I will say this, there will be a big story coming, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, that will definitely be, will really hit home closer than we would imagine. I have to sit on my hands about it, but it will be a big damn deal. And I think we will then see where the police commission will have to come out and a lot of other people have to come out, and it will be something they can't avoid. And so that's why, for me, I've kind of laid low a little bit more on really holding, you know, saying much about them. Because I'm like, look, they're going to have their reckoning very soon. And it's one of those things where I just feel like with us, though, I think we don't, you know, we have been positioned and weaponized against each other. Black people in this community have been weaponized against each other by the city, by politics, by, you know, class, money, and everything else. What has happened is they have put money into the coffers of certain designated leaders in this community not to respond. Their silence have been paid for and bought by the powers that be. And when you have a situation where people are being paid, that money is loyalty money, and that money creates silence, and that money controls who empathizes for who. I mean, we look at this Michael White situation. There's a reason why, you know, Councilman Kenyatta Johnson stuck his neck out without all the facts or details for the real estate developer, Sean. But, you know, when it got to Michael White, he was very he minced his words. He you know, kind of was very general. He didn't really go into saying much. And that's because they cherry pick what they can push and what they can't based on who's feeling their money. And I'm going to say something that's really going to be blunt, and this is not our fault, but this is just the thing. Black politicians are not going to stand up for black people in these communities because those are not the people that fund their campaigns. They don't fund their campaigns. They, you know, when you look at the real estate developer, his company gave money to Kenyatta's campaign, and he individually gave money to Kenyatta's campaign, and that is in campaign finance records, that there is a financial relationship between the developer and Kenyatta. I mean, Kenyatta has a relationship with a lot of developers, and the reality is that people are going to respond to their base. The same reason why we don't have Made in America in the Parkway is because those Parkway people, whoever up top made those complaints, were people that put money in the mayor's coffins. The reason why we didn't have neighborhood racism addressed is because those racist bar owners was campaigning. Look, Woody's, who was cited for racial discrimination, had a big Mayor Kenny banner in the neighborhood for him when he wanted to go for election. So their loyalties lie with who's financing them and giving them money. And black folks in this city as a collective don't donate to campaigns. And I don't know if we should or we shouldn't. I don't really think that's necessarily what we should be discussing, money and politics, in that way. But we need to understand, we need to stop pretending like we don't understand why we don't get up for our own. And a lot of times we have gotten the powers that be are kind of driven by money. If you ain't giving me money, if you're not donating me this, if you're not giving me this grant, then I'm not going to say anything to rock the boat. So we have been bought out and sold out and bamboozled by the powers up top. And that's why we don't see these. We see people who oftentimes speak abstractly about criminal justice, not talk about it specifically. You know, where's Jordan Harris on this? I mean, he talks all day about criminal justice, and this happened in his actual district. He's not going to say anything because the money and the powers that be, you know, he's not that doesn't align with his current situation. Look at who donates to these people, and look where, and that's where you can see where their loyalties lie. Period.
Okay, but you brought up Michael White. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, this is still going on. I got a statement from the DA's office yesterday talking about, you know, the charges that have been leveled against him and why they've been leveled and you know, the evidence that they have. I know, Christopher, that you've been talking to them about releasing the video.
Yes, show the video.
And I guess what kind of, how is that moving forward?
So my last conversation with Ben Waxman at the DA's office, they don't have any plans to release the video right now. I mean, there's public interest, clearly. There's heightened public interest in this story. But the difference between this video and, let's say, the video of David Jones being killed is that this video involves two private entities. There was no public official involved, and so they kind of have to weigh that matter and saying, yeah, there's a public interest in this, but this is a complaint or an issue between two private citizens. There's no inherent public value to this video that will compel a release, and so there may have to be some consulting with the parents. But if this video is shown at the preliminary hearing or in court, it has then become subjected to public records, can then be you know, requested by a Freedom of Information Act request. But so that's where we are in the video. As far as the case is concerned, I was at the vigil on Sunday. It was Kenyatta's neighbor. I talked to Kenyatta about the perception that he's doing this because this gentleman was a donor. He said that he wasn't a super donor, but that he was more of a friend. He wasn't denying that he wasn't a donor at all, but that this was done as a neighborhood to try and remember this guy. For the part that I saw, it wasn't political. They didn't assign blame. It was more of a moment to grieve. And I think that, but to Ernest's one point, I think there should be a reserving of judgment on all sides on this story regarding who did what until we see the video and get more facts. But what I do know about this case, what doesn't need any more reservation, is that this young man should not be charged with murder and be held without bail. For first of all, he's not a flight risk. He has ties to the community. There's reputable people who have spoken up for him. He's involved in the Philly Youth Poetry Movement. He's a college student, or was a college student, who raised his own money to go. So he should not be sitting behind bars without the option for bail in a place that's probably going to make him more dangerous and more desensitized to violence. I think the DA's office will eventually drop the charges, or the charges will be dropped, or I should say diminished to maybe voluntary manslaughter. So the DA's office is going to have a really hard time trying to prove murder, trying to prove that gentleman intended to kill Mr. Schellinger when he rode down Chancellor Street. So what I'm looking forward in the coming days and the coming weeks is potentially the video being released, this gentleman getting bail, and those charges coming down from murder to maybe manslaughter or something like that.
I'm looking forward to the autopsy coming out.
So, but I want to go back to something because I want this a question that I've had all along, and you just said it, Flood, is that so he is there without the option of bail right now?
Yeah, he doesn't have bail.
Yeah, he's there without bail. Mm-hmm.
And whose decision is that? Is that the judge's decision or is that the DA's decision?
That's the DA's decision. They choose who gets bail. They choose what the charges are. It's coming from Krasner, y'all favorite DA.
I think those implications, that implication is
coming from Krasner. I think it needs to be noted that when a murder suspect turns themselves in, typically they are arrested and remanded without bail immediately. So it's not as if this is something that's unique to Krasner, or that he should be vilified simply because he ran on a more liberal agenda. This is very typical of what happens when someone is murdered and a suspect is turned in. I think because of the narrative around the murder, because we know that this gentleman, this young man was a young black student, it catches us as a little off-putting on why he's behind bars. And again, right. I am advocating for him to be released on bail.
If this was a white boy, if this was a young white boy, he would not have been charged with. He would have not been. If this was a young white boy, this would be a different story. That's just going to be my opinion.
But people are charged with murder and arrested immediately all the time in this city.
Well, here's my question.
It's interesting that, like, but here's the issue though, is that black people are always positioned. We have been taught that this is through slavery, through generation, that we always have to be objective in the face of a system that we know is not objective whatsoever. And we continue to have this idea of organization and procedure as if any of those things really do exist. And we know it does. We know it does not apply the same way to us. And even the framing of this entire case and how it's been portrayed and how Kenyatta, first of all, Kenyatta doing what he did was political. It was political. He's a politician. The way in which he's spoken about this man from the jump, the way in which he says he's neighbors, that's nonsense. There's a relationship beyond just him donating finances. Like, you're not friends with a big, huge developer in the city and just play it like, oh, that's one of my little friends. Almost like when he was acting like he lived in Point Breeze when he didn't, said, I just used a little water. I'm sick of the shenanigans. There's politics there. We know that that was a bold statement. Him coming out, he showed where his alliances lied right then and there to divorce himself for accountability. And the funny part is now he's put himself in a hole, because as more details come from this investigation, I'm expecting him to say more about that too. And he probably won't. And that's because he made it known from the top what his position was and where how he felt. As far as all these other things go, as far as criminal charges and murder and things like that, I mean, yeah, there's procedures and all these things, but the implications of it still remains that this 20-year-old is in jail with no bail and has to wait till August 1st to figure out what's going to happen next for him. And I think for me, I'm not just waiting for this video, but I'm also waiting for the autopsy, because when Sean Shelliger's body gets inspected, I want to see that he was intoxicated, because that will prove that these two men were lying, the two living men that was in that Mercedes that claimed that no one was intoxicated. Because when it comes out on the autopsy that he was highly intoxicated, because apparently he went to Rouge or went to one of those restaurants, you can't tell me on a late Thursday night a man who is known for going out and drinking and living a high lifestyle did not have a couple of drinks for dinner that night. And it's come on. So I'm not going to pretend like I have to figure out every single detail, because that's the burden of proof, and that kind of stuff is not given for us. And I'm not going to allow myself to just take whatever the DA's office is throwing at me as a bone. Now, I know that his court date is August 1st at the Criminal Justice Center at 10:30, room 306 at 10:30 a.m. August 1st. I won't be here to go because I'll be in Detroit. But for everybody else, people need to show up and really start looking very carefully at what is being said and who is saying it.
Well, here's
at this point,
The question that I've had ever since I read the statement from the DA's office regarding the charges. How do you charge someone for murder based on a piece of cell phone evidence and some eyewitness testimony when it's coming from a place like Rittenhouse Square, where there are literally cameras everywhere? And if we learn nothing else from the whole Starbucks thing, we know they have an overwhelming police presence.
Correct. Well, the camera incident, Denise, I went and visited 17th and Chancellor Monday evening and walked up that alley from 18th and Chancellor to 17th and Chancellor. And the majority of cameras are pointing either towards doors of alleyways, garages, and clubs, or they're pointing directly down at the street. The stabbing happened at the corner, and unfortunately, from what I can see, there's no cameras that point directly to that area. It's almost as if that was a blind spot. Break in the case, if you will, may come from the fact that there's a new restaurant that opened at 17th and Chancellor called Spice Fence. It's a Mediterranean bar and kitchen. They've been open for about a week or two, and there's a huge window in the front that faces 17th and Chancellor. And so They do last call at 10 o'clock, but by 10:30, 10:40, there's still usually patrons in there, I was told, by a hostess. So it's very possible that there were people in that restaurant when this stabbing happened who have yet to come forward. There was clearly, there's no way that I'm going to believe that there was only one person who was recording. That's just the one video that has come forward. 17th and Chancellor, right off Rittenhouse Square, Thursday night in the summer. There had to be plenty of people who saw what happened. And so I'm waiting for and hoping that the DA's office and the police department would be very dogmatic in this. I know, and just to back up too, I don't think the DA's office had to approve a murder charges. They did. I understand why they did from a protocol standpoint, but they didn't have to. And I think the larger point for me was that this represents, as does other cases, it represents two systems of justice. Why does Ryan Powell now, who killed David Jones, get to live a free life while his criminal case is investigated? He may be charged with murder, but he's allowed to be out on the street while regular citizens, including Michael White, get charged immediately. Now, they said that they got probable cause for a murder charge from the video. You mean you tell me you can't get probable cause for murder charges for Ryan Powell based on the video? I'm almost sure that the video of David Jones being killed is less ambiguous than the one of Michael White.
I mean, there would respond to public pressure. I mean, that reality is that there was phone calls made. You don't think there was phone calls made from the mayor's office? You don't think that there's private backdoor conversations? There was this, I mean, I think what Krasner signed up against is that he had to look. Yeah, public pressures. I mean, that's why I'm saying that all this protocol stuff, yeah. But also the protocol allows for people like Ryan Powell not to have to spend a day in jail behind something that was also murder, right? And in a situation like this where you're dealing with two private citizens, there is speculation of intoxication. There is all of these other variables that are out there. You know, to me, it's weird because they said it was traffic. So if it was traffic, that means that by default there was a lot of people out there. This was tight traffic. It was intense. That means there were people out there in the streets. This was a lively street. It can't be, this is so random at a red house, but it was found in the videotape. But then also they kept saying it was traffic. So by default, I mean, there were cars lined up against each other. So a situation like this on a Thursday night where there's all this commotion out on the street, a tight street, and it's traffic, clearly most people saw what the hell was going on in there. Clearly there was some cameras or something that's got to be shot. I'm just tired of these institutions trying to insult my intelligence and insult others. And I think that's right. What I'm observing is that every time these things happen with black people, we're sitting here, I mean, not us, but we as a community have to scratch our head and try to figure out all these different things when it comes to us. But when it's the other way around, it's always quick defense. It's self-defense. Yeah. He was scared. He should have worn a hoodie. He should have been thinking where he was going. He should have had his hands out. But we don't say things like, in this case, he should have not got his ass out that car. He should have minded his business. He should have learned. Him and his friends should have stayed in the car. They should have been drinking that night. I mean, we don't say that, you know.
Right.
And but we do it to black people every day.
We got a caller on the line. Tim from South Philly, friend of all of ours, wants to weigh in on this conversation. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Oh, listen, sir. First of all, when I hear Flood on it, and Denise and Rev and you and the other brother who calls in a lot, and it gives these exposure, man, I feel real good, man, that I'm going to be looking at this case. I'm in South Philadelphia, man. And I know Flood's going to do a good job. I'm just waiting for Ike to come out of the back room, man, and just put the icing on the cake. So I'm going to be looking at this, man. I am going to be looking at this, Flood. I miss you, Flood.
I appreciate that, Brother Tim. I miss you too, my friend.
All right. So man, I'm going to be watching, man. And this has to be exposed, man, because we're looking at some interesting stuff here. We're looking at the stuff that Philadelphia is suffering from, gentrification. Favorites, politicians not doing what they're supposed to do, a young man who's home for the summer, who's working in order to go back to Morgan State. I mean, I don't know all of the issues and the facts of the case and what is all hearsay, but I'm looking for justice, man. I'm looking for justice. You know, I'm going to be watching, man. Okay? All right. I'm going to listen to this station because you're giving me the best news. This station's giving me the best news, man.
Well, Brother Tim, call Krasner's office. Call the DA's office and tell him to lower the charges, that they're not going to be able to prove murder and that that's an overcharge. That's the first thing we can all do is call the office of the DA and say, you can't charge this kid with murder. You got to give him bail and give great consideration to releasing the video.
That's
okay,
right.
Sir. All right. Good advice. I'm on it. Have a good day.
You do the same.
All right. Well, listen, gentlemen, we're running out of time, unfortunately, this morning. And so I'm going to give you guys a minute each to kind of wrap up your final thoughts on this. Well, actually, before we get out of here, let me just get your thoughts on this latest flap with the mayor and Jay-Z before we go.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that each of you has some thoughts. Go right ahead. Ernest, I'm going to give it to you first, then Flood.
Okay, my bad. I'm sorry.
No, sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. You go for it. Go ahead, Flood. Get out, because I know you probably, I don't want you to forget your thought. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just want to say that there was a lot of innuendo that I was reading online about why the decision was made for Made in America. And so I had a chance to talk to the mayor yesterday about it, as well as Darryl Clark. And it's interesting to mention that Darryl Clark learned about the news from the radio, and he seemed a bit salty that he wasn't bought in and consulted on that. But they both cited this study from the Parkway Council that they are actually in favor of minimizing the Parkway for a lot of events, not just Made in America. And Darryl Clark said yesterday that he supports minimizing the Parkway for live event areas because the infrastructure just can't handle it. There's a lot of stress on the infrastructure, there's operational difficulties, and there's been complaints for at least 10 to 12 years about the events on the Parkway. So the Made in America has only been there six. Council president says the complaints date back for at least 12 years. So it's not just Made in America that's in jeopardy here on the Parkway. It's this whole idea of having big events there. I think the shame is Philly may lose its reputation as being able to welcome and attract big events, which I think Michael Netter did a great job from 2012 to 2016, at the very least, of making Philadelphia more marketable and more attractive. And I think the Kennedy administration may be undoing some of that work.
So, I mean, my thoughts on this simple. He should have – there's clearly a misunderstanding, miscall. I mean, the issue is it's not – if the Parkway has issues with infrastructure, you know what I don't like is we find out all the reasons after the fact that the damage has been done. It's sloppy communications on the part of the city in communicating this with Mayor Kenney. And to be quite honest, you know, no one was saying this for Wawa Welcome to America, which has been going on the Parkway way longer than Made in America, but Made in America got to take the brunt of all of this. And I feel like in many ways there should have been a conversation with, you know, Rock Nation before about potential. Like, you need to give people alternatives. The fact that Jay-Z and that team didn't even have the option to know what other locations were available. The fact that the city has been sloppy on not providing alternatives for other big shows to be happening in the city and not giving people the opportunity to choose is also a problem. And it just shows that they didn't care. From a close source that I know who used to work – I'm going to finish this. From a close source that I know who was connected to this before Mayor Kenney got in office, said that Mayor Kenney was always not a fan of Made in America and did not like the music and the vibes. And so Mayor Kenney has had – his administration had a problem with the music, the type of festivals we have. He didn't like the Roots at the 4th of July. The Roots got cut. He is not a big fan of Made in America for the fact that it was too urban and he felt like the music had too much vulgarity, and he was not a fan of it being over there anyway. And so a lot of this is, yes, sure, there's stuff about infrastructure and all that crap, but a lot of this also has to do with culture. Because, like I said, there's a lot of things that do go on at the Parkway, and we're not seeing these abrupt lack of communication. They're talking about it was an RFP, it was in this. But it's very clear that if Jay-Z has to write a scathing op-ed in our own local paper, there's clear that there was an issue with communication and transparency in this.
Right.
This could have happened a lot smoother. So, find alternatives.
We'll pick it up
don't be evicting people. So.
We'll pick it up on Monday, gentlemen. Hey, yes. We got to get out of here. This is Mark and Denise in the morning.
Have a good day, everybody.
Peace.
If you're a homeowner, landlord,